Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to listen today. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Well, as many of you are aware, we do have the YouTube channel up and running. We're kind of going full force on that. I've got the beekeeping tip of the day every day in the month of September. If you like it and it turns out that people are really digging it, then we will keep doing it for maybe the rest of the year. We'll have to see how that goes. If there's an idea or a tip of the day that you want to share, let me know. Join us in the Discord room. You can go to the Beekeeping for Newbies homepage. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. I keep reminding people because there is the other newbies, which while I'm sure they're really good people, they do have the same name. I don't want them to get free publicity. So feel free to join us on the website. There's links in there to the podcast, which you guys already know about, but there's also links in there to all of the In the News articles, links to YouTube and all the other things that we have. But it's youtube.com and then /@beekeepingfornewbies. So you can find us over there. But if you have any suggestions, something you'd like to see in the tip of the day or anything else we can help out with, let us know. All right, everybody. So today we have a guy that I kind of jokingly and affectionately refer to in the community as kind of like the godfather of beekeeping. But we have a gentleman who's been very active in bees for a really long time. He is a scholar, a practitioner, a scientific kind of person, and just somebody whose name you're going to recognize right away. He goes to lots of the different conferences and expos and presents around the world. You'll see him on the National Honey Show YouTube channel. You'll see him in other places in YouTube and all over the world. Well, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Randy Oliver. Randy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
You bet.
Well, hey, so I know you're out in California, and I know that you know you're running the scientific beekeeping website. You're very active in the bee community all over the place, and you're presenting at various conferences and shows. If you wouldn't mind, could you take a few minutes and just kind of get us back to kind of step one, a little bit about you, you know, how you were raised or born and anything that might be important about how you got into beekeeping, anything that we might be interested in?
Sure. I was always a born naturalist from a young child. I grew up in Southern California back before it was houses. My area was farmland back then in Newport Beach, California, ranch land in orange groves. It got built up around me, but I was able to grow up out in nature very much. My favorite books were my father's college of biology textbooks as I was growing up. And I was very interested in science and biology. And we got a bee swarm landed at a neighbor's house when I was around 14 years old. And I put on a face mask and a sweatshirt and gloves and put the bees into got them into a cardboard box, having no idea what I was doing. And then asked around, and my father, who was a high school teacher, said, hey, one of my students mentioned that her father was a beekeeper. He was a commercial sideline beekeeper, a couple hundred hives. And he has always getting older. Had a weak back. I was young with a strong back. So I learned beekeeping the traditional way by apprenticing to an experienced beekeeper. And it's kept me since I was a teenager. Went on to get degrees in biology. And work in insect culture and set up the insectary at University of California, Irvine. Went on later on, moved up north to the woods and then ran a farm store, got very much interested in agriculture. Got a master's in fisheries biology and fish culture, actually. And all of these things turned out later. And plus, meantime, I put myself through school as a builder. A contractor, a laborer first, building houses and learned how to build houses foundation to finish. So I learned all the trades for construction, and that's what put me through school. All these things turned out to be very handy later on when Varroa started hitting me hard. At that time, I was shifted to doing teaching, middle school teaching for science. Again, something else that helped. Finally, I realized, man, why am I letting this might kick my butt. I've got degrees in entomology, background in animal culture. When I was in school and stuff, I had the ability to build things. I could weld and do construction and electrical and all that. So all the other grad students who always asked me to help them out. And I wound up started doing some research on my own, self-educated. About Varroa and honeybees much deeper. and to learn how to keep my colonies alive. And let's see, I was asked to speak once after I wrote my first article for ABJ, and the beekeepers were just so interested in hearing from somebody who actually made their living as a beekeeper, which I was by that time, and could translate the science into common language. So for my experience teaching science elementary, it helped me a whole lot too. I was used to translating science to people who weren't, they were kids, but it makes no difference to them. Adult beekeepers, anybody who doesn't have a formal scientific background can often use a translator to make sense of what the scientific literature is. So that's kind of the niche. There was an unfulfilled niche that I fell into, kind of as an extension apiculturist, but not associated with any university, and having the great freedom to not work for either the government or university, which gave me the freedom to say whatever I wanted to say. If you work for any of those organizations, you have constraints upon what you can say in case it might offend somebody or not toe the line. So I had the freedom to be able to do research or criticize other papers, question other findings, and that was very, very helpful. And it just grew. And all my skills, being able to build things, do my own research projects, my background in the various biological fields, and my experience many years as a beekeeper, making my living as a beekeeper, all worked to put me in this place as a total surprise. Like, just totally, absolutely, there was no planning whatsoever. My wife at the time goes, "What in the world is happening?" You know, and it was an unfulfilled niche out there, and I just happened to step into it. It just sucked me in. Anyway, what keeps me going is I'm all about service. I love teaching. I love helping. I've always given everything away. I've always lived hand to mouth. What motivates me is the appreciation of others for being able to do something for society, and in this case, the society of beekeepers. That and as I travel around the world, it is that appreciation from the beekeepers, and especially in the more third world countries where, you know, people are just they're feeding their families from their beekeeping operation, and they don't get good information from necessarily their governments or whatever on how to do it, and they can't read the scientific literature, and they're just all ears of just practical experience as a beekeeper, not theoretically, but what actually works in their hives. And that is so gratifying to me. They invite me to the bee yards and we talk out there. That's what I really enjoy.
That's awesome intro, Randy. And you know, there's so many things that you said just now that resonated with me. You know, I think that you never know what life's journey is going to take you down, you know, which path and how it's going to go. And, you know, my story is a little bit, has some interesting, you know, intersections with yours. You know, being a jack of all trades comes in handy quite a bit, especially when you have to fabricate things in the bee yard. And, you know, one thing that is always a huge challenge, and you hit the nail on the head, is, you know, I started out as a hands-on beekeeper. I didn't have any of the scientific thing. I was just, you know, the Cro-Magnon in the bee yard, just banging around trying to figure things out. And having people like yourself and who are able to take the scientific and translate into common lay terms and help people understand just the very basics without inundating them with a lot of terminology and things, it's tough to find the balance sometimes, but it's a critical component. And you know, you mentioned about working with families and different people in other countries that are trying to, you know, feed themselves through beekeeping. I had a gentleman reach out to me from Kenya about a week ago. And he's like, "Hey, we're doing this big thing in Kenya. We're trying to stand up a beekeeping entity. You know, can you help us out?" So we'll kind of see what happens with that. But when I think about your website, and for those of you out there who don't know, Randy has the website scientificbeekeeping.com. And a few things that just right away that stood out to me is at the top, you kind of say, "Hey, look, this is for everybody. Whoever wants to use the material, by all means." You're not trying to hoard the information, which also speaks to, in practice, what you just said, and being able to say, "Here's the information, run with it." I'm not saying that I'm the master of the universe by any stretch of the imagination. You know, let's have a dialogue. Let's have, you know, be open to being challenged. I tell people all the time, I don't mind being wrong, but let's just have a good discussion about it. Don't point at me and you know, be mean about it. So all those things make a lot of sense.
And feel free to say, I don't know. I get anybody who answers every beekeeper's question can answer every one is bluffing. Yes, nobody knows all the answers. So I have great respect for people who, when asked a question, say, feel free to say, I don't know. And you'll hear me say that clearly. If there's something I cannot back up with hard data. It's just so easy. The temptation for people always is to make up an answer if you don't have a evidence-based answer.
Well, I know that you use that in practice. I watched a video of you just the other day. I think it was one of the ones that came out recently on the Honey Show YouTube channel. And somebody says, hey, Randy, can you tell me about this? And you just said, yeah, no idea. Never done anything with that. So that transparency goes a long way, I think.
Yeah.
So another thing that you mentioned on your site where you say that you're a proponent of whatever works for you beekeeping. You know, this is another thing that I try to advocate to people, that if you ask, you know, 10 different beekeepers, hey, how do you keep bees? Now, obviously, it's a very generic, high-level question. But if you ask 10 people, you're probably going to get 8 or 10 different answers. And, you know, I always try to emphasize, because, you know, the podcast and most of the people listening, I would say the majority of our listeners are, you know, 0 to 2 years of experience. And then we have a lot of stragglers outside of that. But it's really geared towards kind of the brand new beekeeper. And with that, there's a lot of, you know, misinformation, things that people who have the best of intentions.
Oh, yes.
and I'll give you an example. I had a young lady out in Colorado. She reached out to me. She says, Jeff, I'm having this problem. This is what's going on. She explains the whole situation. And I said, okay, I'm a big advocate of, you know, join a bee club or find a mentor, find someone local to you who can guide you. So I said, do you have a mentor? And she says, I sure do. And I said, great. What is your mentor saying? And she says, well, my mentor said she only does inspections about every 6 weeks. And my jaw dropped. I was like, she said, what? Like, you can't do that. That's not going to work. So there are folks out there who aren't always giving the best of information as well, which introduces its own set of challenges.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have the Dunning-Kruger curve where the being unaware of your own incompetence and the inflated self-assessment you have. And many, you know, early on beekeepers, just a few years experience, think, oh my God, everybody else is stupid. I understand everything. They get their blog going on that. And that is inflated self-assessment. We have a couple here in my own community. And what I do is I invite them to the field sessions and stuff. And I will give them, slight challenges, you know, say, hey, take a look at this comb. What do you see? Let's do this. Let me hear you answer this question. And then I very nicely point out to them that maybe you shouldn't be answering this question until you know, educate yourself a bit more. And not to criticize them, because I want to train them. I want these people in my community helping other beekeepers, but I want them giving out accurate, useful information, not making stuff up. And, you know, at first, sometimes they set back a bit by that, by me challenging them. And then they realize, hey, Randy actually just wants to help me and help to educate me. And then, so like that, we're doing a field day at the Ag annual Ag Day Fairgrounds coming up here. I got 3 kind of trainees who from the local community who advise other beekeepers, and they all want to come along and say, hey, watch me do the first demonstration, the first group of kids. There's going to be a bunch of group of kids coming. And then you guys can step up and do it yourself. And if you get stuck, you know, just turn to me. But a training session for others, you know, I'm not going to be around forever. And I'm going to pass this information on to others to help. The other thing is I never give recommendations. I never tell anybody how to do anything or what they should do. What I'm happy to do, if somebody has a question, one, I use the Socratic method, and I generally ask a question back. And I don't answer a question directly, and I keep asking questions back until they answer the question themselves. And what I'm trying to show is how to think as a beekeeper, the thought process. Because most beekeepers, especially new beekeepers, have all this terminology and all these options and biology and physics and mechanics and chemistry. All these terms just muddled up in their head, and it's just a mess. And they'll make sentences with a whole bunch of terms, but they haven't really put it together. So what I will do is I will make them continue to ask that question over and over again, clarifying it. And by the time they finally clarify their question, they can usually answer it themselves. So what I'll do is I'll give anybody all the information that they need to inform themselves to make their own management decisions. But I'm not going to tell you what your management decision should be, because it depends on what. The first question I will always ask, if somebody asks me a beekeeping question, I'll say, what is your objective?
Okay.
What's your final objective? And you work backwards from that objective. But if you haven't defined your objective, nobody can answer a question. So if your objective is to have strong colonies for almond pollination in February, that's a long-term objective. Your objective is to make as much honey as you can in June. That's a different objective. If your objective is to avoid swarming in April, that's a different objective. If your objective is to keep as many colonies alive as possible, that's over the winter. That's a different objective. Your objective is to be able to sell queen bees in the springtime. So first thing is, what is your objective? Or to find out, I want to feed pollen sub. I want to save money doing it. Well, now you have two objectives. You want to feed pollen sub, but you want to save money. Once I understand your objective, then I can give you the information to help you then to make your own management decisions.
Yeah, I think that's a solid and sound approach. And, you know, the other portion of that, which I'm sure, you know, obviously you're very well aware of, but a lot of beekeepers aren't necessarily, is, you know, the geographical component of that, where someone will say,
huge component.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, I feel like I have a really good handle on beekeeping within 10 miles of my house, and I have an apiary about 60 miles away, and I feel like I got a pretty good handle on how things go there. Someone calls me from, you know, Western Virginia, because I'm here, you know, in Eastern Virginia, and they say, hey, Jeff, what should I be doing right now around X, Y, and Z? And I don't know. I don't know what the forage looks like out there. I don't know, you know, the conditions, the, you know, the rain, drought, weather, you know, there's a lot of variables. And that's just, everybody kind of thinks it's almost like if you're an auto mechanic in one state, you can go be an auto mechanic in another state. It's a little different.
Oh yeah. Where I live, 10 miles difference, you're in a whole climate, different climate zones out of in the mountains. We have within 20 minutes of our home yard, we can drive to one of our outyards, put our hives down, go through the blackberry bloom for a month until it's over, pick those hives up and move them to 20 minutes in the other direction, and before the blackberries even start blooming. And they can get a second blackberry crop right there. That's within 20 minutes of my home. So it's huge differences in climate and phenology, plant phenology, the timing of the plant bloom, very close to my home. So I'm very much aware of how it changes in other areas.
Sure, sure. Well, if you don't mind, I want to shift over to something, and it goes to something you commented on in the episode on the National Honey Show called Reading the Combs, the presentation that you did. And I thought that was exceptional. If anybody hasn't seen this, please go to the National Honey Show YouTube channel, and Randy's on there doing, you know, a segment called Reading the Combs. And the way you broke down and talked about, you know, here is where the brood is, and this is how much royal jelly you want to see, and when you see this much pollen here and this much there, you know, and really, it was a great explanation. But there was a comment that you made that I wanted to kind of hone in on a little bit. And you said that there are people who say that they want to have kind of a natural environment. And there's a lot of folks who say, like, look, I want to be, as it relates to, you know, Varroa, I want to be treatment free, and I want to do all these things. And my response is always, well, your first step probably as a hobbyist or even a small commercial apiary is, you're going to need to find a reputable VSH queen, you know, queen breeder. And that's probably going to be a good starting point for you. But, you know, from your perspective, you know, again, with that hobbyist, small commercial mindset, do you feel like that's just really something that the professionals kind of have to run with? And a lot of it's out of your hands since you're doing open breeding anyway, or what do you think that the hobbyist beekeeper can do to be more natural?
Well, the first thing, the moment you're a beekeeper, it's not natural anymore. This thing is, if you're going to be a natural beekeeper, you can put out an empty cavity and then pray that a swarm moves into it. That's it. If you do anything else, it's not natural anymore. Now you are managing, okay? It is livestock husbandry. The moment you put bees into a hive, it's livestock husbandry. If you happen to buy those bees from a supplier in a package or a nuke, now you're buying managed livestock that is bred not for survival without care, but for bred for survival with care. Absolutely unnatural. So even using the term natural beekeeping is ridiculous. By definition, keeping and natural are oxymorons. It's two different things. Grass that you are working, first thing, the honeybees do not need saving. One, they are also not native to North America. They are an invasive species in North America. So to be a natural beekeeper in North America is an unnatural thing. You're working with an invasive species as a managed livestock. So just drop that. Now, if you want to be as close to natural as possible, and what you're really trying to say is, the first thing, you are using livestock that has been bred to be adapted to receive supplemental feeding. Any commercial beekeeper pretty much does supplemental feeding. So that's what they feed their livestock for. You take away that supplemental feeding, and then you're stressing that livestock. The second thing is you're not breeding from a population that has developed resistance to this new parasite that the honeybee has, the varroa mite, and the main parasite that it vectors, which is the bee form wing virus, which is what kills most colonies these days. Unless you can find a stock that is naturally resistant, which is very, very difficult still, it's your ethical responsibility for your livestock to manage parasites if the livestock is not already bred for that management. In our own program, we're up to pushing maybe 50% of our stock is exhibiting a strong degree of resistance, and we're able to manage the rest using nothing but the natural treatments. We have used systems that might aside in 23 years now. And so using oxalic acid, formic acid, and thymol are totally doable for management. So it's not like you have to be, pulling into a, quote, chemical beekeeper, although all those things, everything is a chemical. So idealism, I'm a very idealistic person also, but I'm a practical person. So don't let your idealism get to the point where you do negligent animal husbandry. If your colonies are dying from the deforming virus due to inadequate varroa management, and it's a very ugly death for that colony, you're not living up to your ethical responsibility to care for your livestock. So my suggestion to beginning beekeepers is that saying, I'm a natural beekeeper or treatment-free beekeeper, it's just an excuse for inadequate management of your livestock. And that's ethically, I have a problem with that.
So I think that, in my opinion, is the number one single biggest problem with the hobbyist beekeeper. And anybody that I talk to in the community, whenever I have somebody on for an interview and we're having a discussion, I say to them, and it's a kind of a loaded question, but it's a softball really, as far as I'm concerned. So, hey, what do you think the number one most important thing is for a beekeeper? And I tell people, the first and foremost, no matter what, once you've accepted the fact that it's going to cost you, $1,000 or $2,000 to start beekeeping when you thought it was going to be, $50 or $100, I say, if you don't have a plan for how you're going to manage varroa, then you just need to stop right away. If you recognize you are inherently not very proactive, you're a little bit lazy. The joke I made in a video I posted recently, I said, honeybees are not the Ronco rotisserie grill. You can't set it and forget it. You actually have to be very actively engaged. So yeah, that's the same thing I try to beat into the heads of young beekeepers and new beekeepers to try to get a handle on that.
Yeah. Back in the day, before varroa, you could ignore colonies. Back in the day, you'd go to the Sears Roebuck catalog and you'd order your bee boxes and frames. They'd deliver, you'd nail them all together and paint them. And then you'd order your package bees, again, from Sears Roebuck, and they would be delivered. And you put the package into the hive, maybe give them some sugar syrup. And you could walk away from that hive for 10 years and come back after 10 years, and you probably still had a thriving colony. Not with the same queen. They would have swarmed every year. They would have recleaned themselves, replaced their queens with supersedure. It took almost no management to be a beekeeper back then. And those were the golden days. I'd love to return to those golden days. And with some of my treatment, a resistant stock, I can see that will be a possibility, possibly within my lifetime. But until we have fully mite-resistant stock, you're going to have to step in and help them with parasite management.
So when you say that about 50% of your colonies now are exhibiting some of that resistant, you know, behavior, is that more of just on the hygienic? Like, and I don't know if you even have the answer, but are they physically removing mites?
I don't have the answer.
I'm sorry?
I don't have the answer.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you had gotten a chance, because that's really tough to determine and to figure, and I wasn't sure if you had been able to figure that out.
It's not necessary to determine. Okay, what we do is our breeding program uses one metric, lack of mites in the hive. I don't care how they do it. I don't tell them how to do the job. I say the job description and let evolution figure out what works. The reason is when you tell them, if you select for a specific trait, you can be eliminating them. You're saying, oh, you can't use other traits. You have to use this specific trait. I do not want to limit evolution or limit the things, because the reason is that honeybees will come up, if you leave them alone, with ways to fight the mite that you never in your wildest dreams would have ever thought of. The bees are nowhere using molecular biology against the mite. No one would ever have thought of that method, but nature can come up with that. So what I can say is there are some observable traits that my resistant bees are exhibiting that I can see. One is verosimilitude of hygiene. The other is uncapping behavior. And those are very observable traits. So I see that in my stock, but that's not what I select for. I'm selecting for the end result. You can have colonies that exhibit verosimilitude of hygiene, and you can have colonies that exhibit uncapping behavior. But that doesn't mean that they're going to be mite resistant, that they're going to keep their mite counts low. So what I want to do is to make sure that they keep their mite counts low. So that's all we do. As long as they keep mite counts, you know, at 0 to 1 mite level, all right.
When I was little, my grandmother had bird feeders and a bird bath in her backyard. Some of my favorite memories growing up were listening to her tell me everything she knew about the feathered friends that visited her yard daily. How amazing would it have been for us to be able to capture images and videos of that experience and to be able to share them with others? Well, if you're ready to take your backyard bird watching to the next level, FeatherSnap makes Wi-Fi enabled smart bird feeders that blend the best of technology and nature. Get a high-def glimpse of your feathered friends with a top-of-the-line camera so every visitor can be seen with clarity and detail. A unique dual-feeder bin helps attract more species, and built-in solar panels keep your camera's battery going strong. FeatherSnap's mobile app creates a truly immersive experience, allowing you to collect and organize your favorite pics and videos and earn badges along the way. Best of all, FeatherSnap offers expert-trained AI identification of more than 275 North American species thanks to their in-house ornithologist. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com. As most of you know, I'm a big fan of the outdoors, and most of my time is dedicated to beekeeping and gardening-related discussions. But you probably did not know that one of my responsibilities as a kid was caring for our houseplants. Yes, part of my $5 a week allowance went towards making sure all of the houseplants were healthy and happy. We used to have shamrocks, Christmas cactus, philodendron, and more. Which leads us to today's podcast sponsor, and a special thanks to Palm Street. Palm Street is the best live shopping app for the plant lover community. You can buy and sell rare plants, crystals, ceramics, and other unique goods. Connect with trusted plant sellers and nurseries that sell nationwide. Shop 24/7 and with live human customer support. What I love most about Palm Street is joining a live stream where sellers walk through all the details and characteristics of the plants they're offering. You can get live answers to your questions and see what questions others have asked as well. It's such a great way to engage for buyers and sellers. And as a special offer, new users will receive $5 app credit, 10% off their first order, and up to $6 off shipping for 3 orders. Palm Street, available on Google Play or the App Store.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Let's see. So what I did is, we have a Discord room, and there's a little over 300 people in our Discord room. It's, you know, all talking about honeybees and bee-related things. And I created a channel within there that just said, you know, Randy Oliver interview. And I said, hey, if you guys have any questions for Randy, let me know. So I kind of compiled, you know, several of those, but I haven't quite gotten into that. I have this problem, and I don't know if it's unique to beekeepers or just people who are chaotic minded like me, but my brain is all over the place all the time. So unfortunately, I don't necessarily have the best order to some of these questions, but some of them are things that, you know, you kind of already touched on a little bit. So if it makes sense, I'll just kind of jump in. And yeah. So one thing that I hear people say all the time, and it comes up pretty regularly, and they say, well, you know, my flow was wrapping up, so I'm going to start supplemental feeding because I really want to build up that population. And I always say to them, well, let's have a discussion about that, because, you know, a lot of people say, well, I just want to keep drawing comb all summer or all, you know, all fall. I want to keep drawing comb. And I say, well, what do you expect them to do with that comb once they've drawn it all up? That's number one, because, you know, they're only drawing comb if they're expecting to put something in it. You know, is your plan to draw it up and then yank it out? And then question number two, I always say is, or I should say statement number two, if the bees are really good at regulating what they need and recognizing what's available in the environment, what they can put away, when you get in there and you artificially, and I recognize there's times where you don't have a choice. You get a really poor fall flow. You need to help them build up going into the winter. All makes sense. But when you go and you artificially insert a tremendous amount of feed that's probably much more than they need, now you create this massive overpopulation, a lot more mouths to feed over the winter. I was curious kind of what your perspective is on all of that.
Well, the first thing I do is back to what I said. What's your objective? So like for the beekeepers in my community, if your objective is to be an almond pollinator in February, then you need to go into the winter with a large cluster so that come January, there's a large enough cluster that the queen can start laying several covered frames, you know, covered with bees of brood. She's limited by how large the total cluster size is as to how many cells are available that can be kept warm to rear brood. So a small cluster, the queen is choked down. She can't, the colony is unable to build up quickly because they can't keep enough frames ready. So if your income is based on almond pollination and you get paid for how strong your colonies are, then your objective is to build up a big colony in by November with lots of sealed brood, so those bees that emerge become your winter cluster. If, on the other hand, you're a hobby beekeeper and your objective is to avoid swarming in April, well, then you don't want to go into the winter with a large colony. You want to go in with a moderate-sized colony, so it'll grow to full size at BNR nectar flow, which comes about the middle of May. So two people living in the same place are two different beekeepers, but they have different final objectives.
That definitely makes a lot of sense, absolutely. You know, when you said
so
that...
Just feeding... So, and here, in August, they say, well, wow, my colonies have shut down brood ring. There's no pollen coming in. They look almost like they're queenless because the nurse bees are cannibalizing the eggs as fast as the queen lays them. The queen might lay 1,000 eggs a day here during August, and the nurse bees follow behind and eat 1,000 eggs a day. So it looks like it's queenless. Said, oh, wow, should I feed pollen sub? I say, well, yeah, if your objective is to raise varroa mites, because varroa mite food is sealed brood. So if you start feeding them now, you're going to create sealed brood, so you're going to be feeding the varroa mites. Not a one of those bees raised in August will ever survive to form the winter cluster. So there's no benefit from feeding in August to make a larger winter cluster. What we use is the August breed when they are not rearing brood to control varroa mites. That's the easiest time, is when there's very little sealed brood to control varroa mites, get the mites down, and then the colony can purge the deforming virus infection. And then come mid-September, then you can step up the game, start giving pollen sub and some syrup to stimulate the natural nectar and pollen flow, and build up healthy bees that are not infested by a mite or infected with deformed wing virus. And those are bees that will form a healthy winter cluster of, quote, winter bees.
Yes, being in a position with that, the break in, we have the same thing. We have about a 7-week dearth here that runs about, you know, early to mid June to early to, you know, early August kind of time frame before that fall flow kicks in. And that's where I tell people, I'm like, hit them hard, get that varroa knocked
hit
down. Make sure you get it under control because. I read it or I saw it in one of your recent videos as well where, you know, you commented like, hey, if you're saving them in August, September, like they're done. That's it. It's too late. You know, DFW is there and that's it. or DFV, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the airport.
But anyway, just look for those windows of opportunity in your local area when the colonies are not making honey, and especially if there's any kind of dearth. Those are perfect for rural management. The other thing I found early on is that feeding pollen sub when there's any natural pollen flow on is a waste of money and time, because the bees just suck the syrup out of the pollen sub and keep the particles out, because they'd rather eat the natural pollen that's coming in. So just doing things by rote rather than for specific reason or understanding doesn't help. And many beekeepers just, beekeeping is not like baking brownies. You don't just follow the simple recipe on the back in every situation and get the same meal. That's not going to happen.
Yes.
So you don't do things by rote. You have to understand what's happening in your environment. And that's why I wrote that series, Understanding Population Buildup and Decline, which is pretty much summarized in the video, Reading in Combs.
Yes, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. I'm sitting here, I'm still laughing because I'm seeing so many times and stories of people, well, this is all you have to do. I'm like, no, it's not right. All you have to do. And like we talked about earlier, the importance of, you know, as anyone is messaging anything, it always has to be like, yeah, your mileage may vary because this is what I see here, and you're going to see something different potentially. So
yeah.
Well, while we're
talking about drawing comb, bees can only draw comb if they are producing white wax. So if you're not seeing white wax on the edge of the dark combs in the hive, that kind of white frosting.
Yes.
That's what we call that white wax. That means that they're activating their wax glands, the mid-age bees are, and they're producing new beeswax. They will not do that until every available drawn comb is already filled with something, either filled with brood, bee bread, or nectar or honey. Only when they don't have any more room to store anything will they activate their wax glands and build new comb. The last thing bees want to do is build any extra comb. It's very metabolically expensive and no reason to do it. So they won't put their energy into it. So it takes a tremendous amount of incoming nectar or sugar syrup to do that. So like if I'm doing experiments, when I've done experiments on this, you may dump several gallons of honey, even into a single full of bees before they will even consider starting to draw the first bit of foundation. But then once they have filled every comb down below, man, they will start drawing foundation like crazy. But it takes a lot of incoming syrup or nectar in order to get them to actually draw it. And as you said, what's your objective? What you need it for? If your goal is to have more drawn comb with full of sugar syrup the next spring, then that's fine. But other than that, no. One of the things with the drawn comb is that is the most important thing for a beekeeper to have on hand. So as long as you are expanding your number of colonies and drawing foundation, you're going to be very much throttled. Once you have drawn comb on hand in the springtime, beekeeping becomes much easier and management becomes much easier because those bees just hop right on that drawn comb and use it for whatever purpose immediately, as opposed to putting on foundation, which the bees do not recognize as comb. It's just a substrate that they may or may not choose to build out into comb.
Yeah, that certainly is always the annual challenge, especially, I'm still a huge fan. I remember my first couple of years when I was only managing a few hives and, you know, I did everything wooden frame wax foundation, and the bees had great acceptance and I was very pleased with it. And then as I started to grow and I, you know, it was not practical to be building, 100 supers and frames over the winter time. I'm like, okay, well, let's go ahead and try the, wooden frame plastic foundation. I think that was it, right cell. I think it is. And, mm-hmm. and, it's great if you can, pre-coat them yourself and melt the wax and go through the process to get it to where it's a little bit more bee-like. But I have had a lot of challenges. It's really like toss of a coin for getting the acceptance in that sometimes.
Okay, we don't seem to have that. We just buy, they've improved, the manufacturers improved the coating, wax coating on their plastic foundation. And I was hesitant originally with plastic foundation, but there are a lot of advantages if you're a larger scale beekeeper to that. And you can buy it with, you know, triple wax coating, and that just saves the bees the work, because they can manipulate that wax that's already on there into the cell walls without producing wax themselves. So that's the advantage of having that. And the other thing is what wax they're using. And I was at one of the manufacturer's plants, and he led me back to the back room. He goes, "Oh, we buy this wax right here from specific beekeeper in Canada, because in our testing, the bees accept his beeswax on our foundation better than any other wax we've ever tried." And so there's a special little locked room of stacks of pretty crude looking, you know, beeswax there that they use for that purpose.
That's great. That's funny. Okay. Well, yeah, you know, the one thing I learned early on, I think it was probably around my second season where I was introduced to the wax moth, and once they showed up inside the colony with my all wax foundation, they moved laterally right through the colony. I mean, they just went boom, 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 right on through and bored through, you know, 7 or 8 frames pretty quickly. Whereas I noticed with the plastic foundation, I could kind of delay that process a little bit, because at least they had to kind of maneuver all the way around the frame and then move to the next one.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, yeah, I'm surprised you had that kind of wax. Every colony's got wax moth. You put sticky boards in, you're going to find that every hive you have pretty much has wax moth. But the bees keep it under control, but it's always there. It's not like you have an absence of wax moth. And that's normal for the bees to keep under control. It's only when the colony starts to dwindle in strength or get stressed, then that they stop killing the young larvae when they start to grow, and then wax moth can start to take over. Anyway, why don't you go ahead and move on to the next question?
Yeah, sure. So while we were kind of talking in the Varroa space here, you know, I know you've, I think I came across a video not long ago where the name of the video, or at least the title, was Randy Oliver OA Sponges. And I know you've done a lot with the, you know, extended release oxalic acid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that, I mean, obviously, you know about this, but I caught a study recently out of probably, I think it was Penn State maybe, where they said that, you know, there's some scientific research that supports the idea that using multiple forms of Varroa, you know, Varroa treatment has an increased rate of success, which I'm sure most of us are probably seeing. So what I would kind of pass over to you, you know, I would point anybody to the Scientific Beekeeping website to get all the information on this, because you've done a pretty good job of extensively documenting things. But at kind of a high level, you know, if you wouldn't mind talking about, you know, the extended release oxalic acid, and then how you complement that with vaporized or Formic Pro or whatever else you typically do or have success with in your yard.
Trust me. And I'm really happy to hear you as a Southerner say oxalic rather than oxalic and pronounce the name of the acid properly. Now, an experiment that I just did this last week, by the way, is to test whether it is the oxalate ion in the oxalic acid that exhibits the toxicity of the mite, or whether it's just simply the hydronium ion, the acidic hydrogen ion, and show that oxalate is not the active ingredient at all. It is just simply the acidity from the acid. And the reason we use oxalic acid is that of the organic acid, it has the most strength, the highest dissociation constant of the organic acids. So that's why we use it. So it's simply the acidity. So if it tastes sour, is your easiest test. And we use the taste test all the time on these sponges. You just put your finger down on it, touch it, and then taste your tongue. And if it tastes like strong lemonade, it still has, it's having an effect on the mites. If it doesn't have that strong lemonade taste, and it doesn't have the effect. The sweetness in it comes from the glycerin, which your human taste buds interpret as sweet. So anyway, there is an improved product out now in some states now. In other states, there's not. So I just got to put a disclaimer in here that I am not advocating the use of anything for miticidal purposes that is not approved. That said, worldwide, the oxalic acid is being extremely widely used in many countries with great success. And the first thing that beekeepers ask with any treatment is, "Randy, can I just use this all year long?" I said, "Sure, if you want to start a selective breeding program for mites that are resistant to that treatment, just do that. Just use the same treatment over and over again all year long." And now you're in a breeding program for resistant mites. And this is a mistake that beekeepers have made worldwide over and over again. I just got back from New Zealand, where the beekeepers, many of them have been doing this, and same with the U.S. commercial beekeepers, getting one mode of action, either like amitraze or dumethrin, and just using it several times a year, year after year after year. Well, what you're doing is that is a selective breeding program for mice that are resistant to that specific mode of action. And it's just the beekeepers keep shooting themselves in the foot. Now, the other thing is people ask, well, is with the natural treatments, the organic acids or the thymol, are the bees going to be able to develop resistance to them? And the answer is their mode of action is very different. It's more like developing resistance to a blowtorch or a hammer or something like that. It's difficult to develop, but I would never bet against evolution. So we do rotate treatments in our operation. We rotate between oxalic acid, formic acid, and thymol at appropriate times. And on my first year beekeeping webpage, down with the Varroa treatments, there's a chart I made up of which of the natural treatments are most appropriate to use at different windows of opportunity during the season, whether it's during colony buildup, during the honey flow, during the dearth period, during winter. Each one has different times when it works well. So you can use my Varroa model, again, free download on my website, to plan a management strategy for your specific environment and your specific management goals and your breaks that you have available to use different things, say whether or not you have honey supers on or not. And you may have different management strategies what you want to use, but it's very important to rotate treatments, to hit the mites from with different modes of actions. So that helps to avoid the development of resistance.
Now that makes a lot of sense. So I'm going to just, let's see here. I'm going to just kind of like lightning round them with you here and feel free to talk to as much as you'd like or as little as you'd like, but I've got just a few of them here. So, you know, you mentioned in one of your videos where you said, when you go in to do an inspection, have a plan when you go in to do an inspection. So why, and I mean, I have an answer for me, but I'd like to hear from you. Why is this important and what types of things for a new beekeeper, what types of things do you think that should be a part of that plan when they go in to do an inspection?
Okay, well, prior to Varroa, my recommendation was if you don't know exactly what you're doing, what your plan is, just leave the colony alone. They've been doing this for hundreds of thousands of years without any help from humans. And let them do that. Because as soon as you open that lid, you're disrupting the colony. After Varroa arrived, then it changed. Yes, we probably should be doing this. And there's also some problems that you can diagnose. So my suggestion is before you even light the smoker, have your plan, what you're looking for. Much of your answers can be, if you have a double deep colony, can be answered by simply pulling one comb out of the middle of the second box. And that comb will give you an example of how much honey stores there are. So now you're answering the question, do the colonies need food or feeding? It'll tell you how much pollen is coming in and whether or not there is a surplus or not, which again answers whether you might consider feeding pollen sub. Then you look at the brood, and that will tell you is by how much jelly is in the brood and what the brood pattern looks like, if they're experiencing some kind of brood disease, such as American foulbrood or European foulbrood or chalk brood, and how well they're feeding the larvae, how well the queen is laying. And bang, off that first comb, you've answered most of the questions you need in order to make management decisions. So have that plan of, like, don't just go in there. Now, if you're a brand new beginning beekeeper, start with a small colony, start with a small nuc, and be in that hive every single week and learn how to read the combs. Watch as they draw a comb and move to the next comb, the queen starts to lay and watch the larvae. Be in that all the time. You're going to wind up killing queens. You're going to wind up making all your mistakes. But do that when you're learning on small colonies. The best thing to do would be to get two or three very weak nucs. So like when we're selling nucs, we ask, are you a beginner or are you an established beekeeper? For a beginner, we are giving you a disservice by giving you a strong nuc because you can explode into a strong colony within 2 weeks. So, and then it's very hard to learn to work that one. They're better off with a weak nuke so you can watch the colony grow, and your experience grows as the colony grows in strength. So being beekeepers, get in your hives all the time to learn about bees and beekeeping. Experienced beekeepers, minimal inspections. As you learn how often you have to do that, mainly you're looking at nutritional status and brewer status, unless you see indications in the brood there's a brood disease. But that's your three main things you're looking for.
Perfect. You know, I just literally last night was typing to somebody talking about nukes, and I said, hey, you get that nuke, you know, you're going to have three frames of brood. Those things are going to explode. And I literally said the exact same thing. I said, take that thing back to your house. If you don't have it in a Langstroth hive or some other larger configuration, you will have a swarm within 2 weeks. So, All right, everybody. So Randy and I had a great chat today, had a lot of fun, but this is only the first half. I had to divide it up into two segments so that it's kind of a bit more consumable. So this is going to wrap it up for part one, and in about 24 hours, you should see part two available, and you can go ahead and listen to the rest of the interview with Randy Oliver. Outside of that, take care, be kind to one another, and remember, I love you. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
Your time and expertise are valuable, making Focus one of the most important resources to have at work. These days, professionals spend nearly half the work week on written communication, and it can be difficult to stay on task with all the emails and documents you have to get through. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, you can stay focused and quickly get through your work with relevant real-time suggestions wherever you write. It works across 500,000 apps and websites, so it can help with everything, from brainstorming presentation ideas to sounding more confident and persuasive in emails and reports. For 15 years, Grammarly has offered best-in-class communication support and enterprise-grade security on a business model that doesn't sell your data. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.